welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting shows from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levanier, and coming up in this hour, True History. Later on, we'll hear Mr. President with Edward Arnold. But right now, an early broadcast of the famous news series, The March of Time, sponsored by Life and Time magazines and narrated by the now legendary voice of Westbrook Van Voorhis. From December 31st, 1936 on CBS, it's The Year in Review.
Life, the weekly all-picture magazine, enters the new year with Life's four special presses now printing more copies each week than was hoped they would be delivering a year from now. And tonight is the most momentous year since the end of the World War draws to its close. The editors of Life join the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, in presenting by radio a panoramic review of the march of history through the year 1936. Early one January morning, 90 miles northeast of London, on the grey, bleak east coast of England, an icy gale drives through the salt marshes, through the Jubilee Gate of Sandringham House, rattles the windows of a ground floor bedroom where, in an ancient carved four-poster bed, protected by two rows of draft-breaking screens, warmed by giant logs blazing in a great stone fireplace, lies the grey-haired King George V. The King's physician, Lord Dawson of Penn, places a document upon the bed cover.
Your Majesty, the Privy Council has drafted this order, creating a Council of State to act for England during Your Majesty's illness. The Council is composed of the Queen and Your Majesty's four sons. Allow me to put this pen into your hand. Allow me to guide your hand as you sign it to Your Majesty. Thank you, Your Majesty.
His hand guided by the hand of his physician, George Winthrop places his official signature, George R.I., performs the final act of his reign. That night in the 26th year of his reign, as it must to all men, death comes to George Frederick Ernest Albert Winthrop, defender of the faith, emperor of India, George V, king by the grace of God of Great Britain, Ireland, and the British dominions beyond the sea.
Edward Windsor, with the death of His Majesty, my beloved father, do herewith assume the duties of the sovereignty. In the performance of this heavy task, I place my reliance on the guidance of Almighty God and the loyalty and affection of my people.
Hours ago, I discharged my last duty as king and emperor. And now, I have been succeeded by my brother, the Duke of York. You must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to discharge my duties as king, as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love.
The year of the reign of Edward VIII. His contemporaries say he lost his throne because he loved Wallace Simpson, not wisely. Future historians may well say he lost his throne rather because he loved his humblest subject too well. The king, who one day early in his reign was to be found knocking on a ramshackle wooden door in the heart of Glasgow's notorious Stetson slums.
Who is it?
I'm your king. May I come in?
Yes, come right in. Who are you? I didn't catch your name.
I'm your king, Edward Windsor.
Yes, my soul. Let Hugh Queen shake your bonny hand, Your Majesty, and bid you a good welcome to my home.
Thank you, Mr. Queen.
And Your Majesty, this is my wife. Is the tongue tied in your head, woman?
Forgive my man for not knowing your kind sister. But Hugh was blind now this 30 years.
Oh, I didn't know.
And you really and truly the new king?
Yes, little man, I am.
Do you know any tricks?
Well, I know how to make a copper penny stand on edge.
How?
Yeah. You just hold the penny between two fingers
And when you take them away, the penny stands on edge by itself.
Oh, let me try.
Here you are. Tell me, Mr. Queen, do you and your wife and these four little children live all together in this one room?
It's all we can manage from the wee pittance we get from the dole.
But isn't the building of the line of Queen Mary giving jobs to the people in Glasgow?
Aye, it is some. But there are no jobs in Scotland for the likes of me, Your Majesty.
Something must be done. A nation that can build a ship like the Queen Mary has no excuse for letting people live like this.
You're a grand human man, Your Majesty.
Marches on. One night in mid-March, out over the U.S. shortwave radio channels.
WADDS Pittsburgh calling QSD. QSD, distress emergency. Relay message QSD, distress emergency. Clear all low-wave channels immediately. All amateurs off the air, clear channels.
W8FRC calling W8. Flood stage here, 41 feet. Johnstown without food for 2 days. Come in.
U.S. Army and Red Cross will fly supplies immediately, Johnstown. Go ahead.
W8FRC line. WADDS Pittsburgh calling W8BWH. Emergency distress.
Go ahead, Pittsburgh.
Entire business section of Pittsburgh underwater. Flood stress not yet reached. Thousands of refugees without food. Typhoid epidemic imminent. Come in, please.
Army planes will drop blankets and serum, Pittsburgh. I'm relaying your message. Come in. Come in.
Unique heroes of the 1936 flood are the amateur radio operators, who with all other communications washed out, stick to their posts of mercy, supplying vital information in the nation's battle to care for the hundreds of thousands left homeless by the raging March waters. Slowly the floods recede, leaving in their wake damage estimated at $500 million, 150 dead. But the waters do not stop going down after they have reached their banks. Through spring and early summer, the sun beats down from cloudless skies until the acres of green waving grain in the corn belt wilt and turn yellow in the pitiless, unending glare. By midsummer, all that is left of the bumper spring crops are withered stalks, parching in the cracked, powdery soil, and 500,000 farm families go on emergency relief. Says Secretary of Agriculture Henry A. Wallace,
500,000 acres of productive land have been completely destroyed. 150 million additional acres may never grow crops again. After nearly a century as a world food producer, the United States, as of this year, may well become a food importer.
An act of God turns the U.S. Midwest to dust. But in Europe, acts of men in early 1936 turn solemn treaties and covenants to ashes. Reich Sir Adolf Hitler reestablishes Germany's historic Western Rhine with 50,000 troops. And in Geneva, a tottering League of Nations is haunted by a small, dark figure of a man.
Monsieur le Président.
Emperor Haile Selassie I.
Gentlemen, members of the League, 8 months ago, my confidence in the League of Nations was absolute. I regarded it as impossible that 52 nations, including some of the most powerful, should be defeated by a single aggressor, Italy. If I return to Ethiopia, what reply shall I take home to my people?
Oh, the last appearance of conquered black man of the year, Emperor Haile Selassie. But in Berlin, says the triumphant black man of the year,
I haven't got any special technique in the broad jump. I just get back from that line about far enough, and then I get going as fast as I can, and get my feet up just as high as I can after the takeoff, and let it go at that.
Broad jumping, 26 feet 5 and 1/3 inches, U.S. Negro Jesse Owens sets a new Olympic record. His fourth championship of the Berlin Olympics becomes 1936 World Sportsman Number 1. And the political conventions go through their hysterical paces. First, the Republicans in Cleveland. But the Democrats in Philadelphia.
This is the way that Republican saw long ago. 12 long years. Full of grief and tears. Full of grief and tears. They called us dusty, plain cranks, but all they gave us to win our thanks was best of skin and busted flanks. But 12 long years.
Two versions of the political words and music of the year. Simplest of U.S. political techniques, the song parody is quickly supplemented by other, more artful political techniques old as the Republic. And still effective in 1936 is the technique of professional humor. Or the GOP, cigar-chewing, Babbitt-baiting pundit H.L. Mencken takes the stump.
With the Honorable Mr. Landon beside the Honorable Mr. Roosevelt, Landon looks like an honest horse doctor beside Lydia Pinkham.
Great voice, great gesturing, great nose, professional punster W.C. Fields.
I should cast my ballot to Mr. Roosevelt, the man of integrity, a man of the people, a statesman, a showman, a veritable fellow, a great guy.
Political techniques of human interest. Alf Landon visits his 81-year-old childhood nurse.
Annie Baird, guys, it's nice to see you.
I'm so proud of you, Alfred. You've served for dinner, won't you? It's nothing special. Roast beef, mashed potatoes and gravy, and angel food cake.
Angel food cake? Well, that's fine. Thanks, Annie Baird. I reckon I'll stay.
Prime human interest is silver-haired mother of the year, Sarah Delano Roosevelt. First mother ever to see her son elected twice to the presidency.
When he came in the door that day, I thought at first it was my husband, James Roosevelt, dead these 36 years. My son, Franklin, on his vacation on that little yacht, had grown a pair of big, bushy sideburns, just like his father wore 50 years ago. They used to call them mutton chops. Franklin has such a wonderful sense of humor.
1936 version of Grass Will Grow Green in the Street.
I do not promise the moon. I promise only what I know can be performed. Economy and such security as can be provided by a generous people. If the New Deal is returned to power, business as we know it now will cease to exist.
1936 version of A Chicken in Every Pot.
Better conditions on the farms, in the factories, and in the homes of America are leading us to the spiritual figure of the psalmist. Green pastures and still waters.
Election night on the veranda of his Hyde Park home, grinning from ear to ear, victorious Franklin Delano Roosevelt greets his neighbors.
My friend and neighbor, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. It looks like an even greater sweep than 1932.
How about 1940? Yeah.
No.
Third term presidential ambitions, if any, can be laughed off with Roosevelt gusto. But the immediate social and possible 1940 presidential ambitions of another man, a bushy-browed, bushy-haired man, darken even his absence from meeting of the American Federation of Labor Council in Washington.
Gentlemen, John Llewellyn Lewis has applied the arrogant methods of a Mussolini and the cunning, unscrupulous intrigues of a Machiavelli. Like a volcano, he spouts flame and burning lava, spitting poisonous gases over the countryside. There is but one thing for us to do.
Mr. Chairman, I move for suspension of John Lewis's insurgent CIO union.
All those in favor?
Aye!
There's John Llewellyn Lewis.
The Federation suspension order is an act of incredible and crass stupidity. An appalling blunder dictated by personal selfishness and fear. The re-election of President Roosevelt has made the workers of the United States at last conscious of their power. Starting this year, the workers are mobilizing for their great advance.
revolting from conservative U.S. staff unionism of the AFL, starting an aggressive fight with his militant left-wing big unions in coal and steel, and with prosperity back to U.S. industry in 1936, United Mine Worker John Llewellyn Lewis answers 1936 wage increases and workers' bonuses with strikes called at year's end in mighty General Motors. With the key automobile industry as the first objective in his 1937 labor offensive, his 1940 political offensive. But John Lewis' big union of 1936 is dwarfed by a century-old labor problem. A labor problem closer to the soil. Labor no longer benefited by the Supreme Court nullified AAA. Labor even outside the New Deal's unemployment and old age pension plan. 9 million men, women, and children plodding between rows of drought-stricken cotton plants in the southern cotton belt. Their bodies bent double, inching forward on bent knees as cotton pickers have done since the founding of the Republic, from plantation slaves to modern sharecroppers up to this year. But in one field near Stoneville, Mississippi, they do not pick. Instead, watch a young man climb into a strange contraption hitched to a tractor, co-inventor of the first mechanical picker, Mac Rush.
Well, here it is, folks. We say it's a better cotton picker today than the old Model T Ford was an automobile when it was first offered on the market. All right, Jack, start the tractor.
Planters, sharecroppers, buyers, and Negroes follow Mac Rush's cotton picker down the cotton row. Watch its wet spindles lick up cotton balls, sucked into bags.
Shucks, I can pick faster than that thing and never miss a plant.
Not as fast as that, boy. It don't cost more than a dollar an hour to run. It does as much work in a day as 40 hand pickers can do.
Picks up too much staying pawn matter. Makes the cotton about 2 grades lower than hand-picked cotton.
Coaches don't do as good work, but it's got all that mighty scared. If the contraption does we all's work, whose work is we don't do?
Little Notice is the first public demonstration of the first mechanical cotton picker. But concerned are the U.S. government and social-minded inventors John and Mac Rush. Steering a perfected cotton picker will throw a 500,000 cotton-picking southern tenant families out of the one kind of work they know. Make 1936 as fateful a year as the year 1831, when Cyrus McCormick first demonstrated his reaper. Time marches on. In the 12 months of 1936, many a great, many a humble name is left behind for the records of future history. As it must to all men, death came in 1936 to Rudyard Kipling, Britain's voice of empire for nearly half a century. To American cinema actor John Gilbert, and to German Bruno Richard Hauptmann. Political conflict in 1936 brought death in Japan to 4 of the imperial government's most influential cabinet ministers, all within 1 hour, by assassination at the hands of rebellious army officers. In Russia, to 16 old Bolshevik heroes of the Russian Revolution, friends of Nikolai Lenin, and dictator Stalin's newest bloodthirst. And in China, to 46 members of the personal army of dictator Chiang Kai-shek, by gunfire. In a futile attempt to prevent his kidnapping by his subordinate Zheng Chuliang. In a futile sacrifice of life to a devious political maneuver, whose motives, with the release of their chief and the amiable settlement with his kidnapper, are at year's end more than ever hidden in obscurity. To 2 opera singers of another age, their voices scarcely known to 1936, Antonio Scotti and Madame Ernestine Schumann-Heinz. To Ethiopian Ras Nasibu, Emperor Haile Selassie's ablest and most trusted general of Italian poison gas. And to Greek Sir Basil Zaharoff, munitions maker, who sold more weapons of death than any man in any century. Time marches on. Madrid, Christmas Eve, 1936. From Madrid gathered to hear the Misa del Gallo, traditional midnight Christmas mass of the Catholic Church in Spain. Celebrators devout Spaniards, the Nativity of Christ, and its message of peace on earth, goodwill toward men, in the Church's indefinable refuge from violence on Christmas Eve. At 5,000 feet above the city, in the cabin of a rebel bombing plane,
objective coming into sight. What is our altitude?
5,500. Slight tailwind. The sight set.
Right. About 200 yards. Give us straight on.
Objective, now in range.
Objective in sight. Release.
Hurtling down through the clear air, its black glossy cylinder streaking the reflected Christmas moon, serves an aerial bomb, marked with the trademark of Krupp of Germany, perhaps the 10,000th bomb released by Spaniard against Spaniard in the War of the Year. A civil rebellion fought on Spanish soil with foreign planes, foreign armies, and foreign bombs like this one. Missiles which in 6 months have killed 500,000 Spaniards. One bomb hurtling on Christmas Eve caused the singing voices ringing upward through San Ynez sunset. Exclude the church, of the sufferings of Catholic men and women in that struggle, of his own illness and its significance as a sacrifice according to Catholic dogma. Then, his message completed, he lifts his right hand in a last benediction to the 330 million souls he shepherds.
Christ came to scatter as seeds of eternal and imperishable triumph on the face of the earth for men of goodwill.
Audible to radio listeners are the last feeble words of the sick Pope's message. Exhausted, he lies back on the pillow, speaks to the radio man, dismantling the equipment over his bed.
Do you think they heard my final blessing, son?
Your Holiness's voice was undoubtedly transmitted with the utmost clarity.
Thank God. Thank God.
Your Holiness had better try to sleep for now.
Yes, Eugenio. Sleep. The pain is much with me. I cannot be the Pope any longer. I think it is better if I die very soon now.
Dying lies Pope Pius XI as the year 1936 comes to its end, and at the close of the 15th year of his reign, the most crucial period of the Church's modern history. In the person of Achille Ratti, who this week lies dying, racked with a dozen senile ills, the Church of Rome is personified at the year's end. And on the ancient throne of St. Peter, unaltered for 1,000 years, will sit a younger, stronger personification of the Church in 1937. But the old strongholds of Catholicism, Italy, Mexico, Germany, Spain, are closing political doors of steel against the Vatican. And whether the keys of St. Peter, adaptable since the fall of Rome, will fit the lock, no man at this year's end can say. So time marches on as the tremendous marching pageant of 1936 draws to its close. The news pageant was fascinating, stranger than fiction drama. More than 1.5 million families now follow from week to week in the pages of Time, the weekly news magazine. And Life, the weekly magazine of pictures. The news pageant they watch each month in the cinema march of time on the screens of 7,500 theaters, whose memorable scenes they hear reenacted each Thursday night by the radio march of time.
Tonight, the march of time swings into 1937.
The curtain is rising on the great drama of another year. And now even the actors do not know what stirring tragedies, what heroic adventures, what high comedies and low deceptions they must play before the curtain falls. No one can foretell what unknown players will strut to sudden fame or what familiar stars will make their final exit. On this wide stage, nations mightier far than Spain or Ethiopia may keep a rendezvous with disaster. Kings may still renounce their thrones for Cinderella's, and long depressions at last may find their happy endings. Truth is still stranger than fiction, and the great show of 1937 will be as enthralling as the whole struggling world each week can make it. Throughout this portentous year, we hope that time and life and the march of time will succeed in adding immeasurably to your enjoyment of each marching week, to your enjoyment of all the stirring, laughable, heroic, pitiable things that make each new year so richly complex. and so hard to follow. Time marches on. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The March of Time on Tuned to Yesterday from the last day of 1936, presenting a year in review on CBS. It's an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now time for Mr. President, an interesting historical show from radio's yesteryear, as you, the listener, get to try to figure out which president actor Edward Arnold is portraying. With Betty Lou Gerson as Secretary Sarah, this ABC broadcast from November 20th, 1949.
I happen temporarily to occupy this White House. I am a living witness that any one of your children may look to come here as my father's child has. Mr. President, starring Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's Edward Arnold and written by Gene Holloway. Mr. President, at home in the White House, the elected leader of our people, our fellow citizen and neighbor. These are little-known stories of the men who have lived in the White House. Dramatic, exciting events in their lives that you and I so rarely hear. True human stories of Mr. President. In a moment, we'll bring you Edward Arnold as the man in the White House. Many years ago, the president sat in a laddered-backed, cane-bottomed chair and read reports written by young men whose wages he paid out of his own pocket. No telephones plagued him. He could come and go as he pleased. Take a swim in the Potomac or ride in the woods around Washington. Today, the president sits in an air-conditioned office, surrounded by telephones, dictating into a wire recorder. If he wants to walk, he must stay inside the black iron bars enclosing the White House grounds. From the laddered-backed chair to air conditioning, from then to now, many presidents have lived in the White House. Men of differing personalities, tempers, and talents. Our Mr. President, the job is to play them all, and he's done it. Edward Arnold has become the man in the White House. On the street, in stores, he's greeted with, "Hello, Mr. President. We like the show. We know you like it, too. Listen and see if you can name the president upon whom this episode is based." Here's a story that happened in Washington a few years ago. Listen closely and see if you can tell who the president was. The president had many problems, and he intended to closet himself this particular night and study them in quiet solitude. As he was just going into his study, two goats hauling a small boy on a chair came clattering down the White House corridor.
Giddy up! Giddy up! Giddy up!
Yeah, there. Well, what's going on? Whoa, whoa!
Ho, my fine Arabian steeds! Ho!
Hello,
Father.
Well, where are you going behind those two splendid Arabian horses?
Well, I'm going in search of adventure. Would you care to come along?
Well, I doubt if the goats could pull me.
Oh, sure they could. Try it.
Well...
Oh, yeah, try. Those two goats are the finest horses ever bred in Arabia, and they make fine speed in the corridor. Try them.
Well, maybe I'll just sit down and see.
Mr. President.
Uh-oh, looks like we're surrounded, son.
Are those two goats that I see hitched to that chair? No, Mother. Those are Arabian horses. What have I told you about bringing those goats into the house?
Arabian horses, my dear.
Goats are Arabian horses. What have I said about bringing them into the house?
Oh,
I forget. You have a very convenient memory. Mr. President, what did I tell you about those goats being brought into the house?
I forget, too.
The place for goats is not the White House corridor. We've been through this time and time again. Now take them out. Immediately.
Yes, sir.
And then come back. Your father wants to talk to you.
Yes, sir. Come on, goat.
Now, I want to have a little talk with you, Mr. President.
Yes, sir.
How do you expect me to teach that child anything if you aid and abet him in everything?
Oh, he's such a little fellow and he's lonely.
But you're spoiling him. You, I, and the whole country. And it really isn't fair to him. Now, yesterday you took him down to stunts again, and you must have bought out his entire stock of toys.
I didn't have any toys when I was young, and that set of soldiers. Did you get a good look at that set of soldiers, my dear?
I just couldn't keep my hands away from him.
But your purchases didn't end with a set of soldiers.
Well, I bought the things I liked, and then I bought the things he liked. And then I bought the things that his brother would have liked.
But his brother's dead.
I know. I reckon that's why I bought the things his brother would have liked.
I understand. That's why the boy gets extra cookies and candy and extra stomach aches. And that's why sometimes in the night I get up and go in just to reassure myself that he's all right. But I still say it isn't fair to him to spoil him. And we should all watch ourselves. And there's no excuse at all for bringing a pair of goats inside the White House. And you must scold him for it.
Very well, my dear, very well.
A lady to see
me?
Well, my goodness, bring her in out of the rain.
Please come in.
Thank you. Oh, my, you're so true. Here, let me take your wrap.
Oh, thank you. You must be the president's wife.
Yes, I am.
I'm Mrs. Sarah Hale, the editor of Godey's Lady Book.
How do you do?
I realize it's a terrible imposition coming like this without an appointment. But I hope for just a few minutes of the president's time.
Then do come into my study, Mrs. Hale. I am the president, and I should be most happy to talk to you.
Thank you. I know how busy you are.
You talk to the boy for me, will you, my dear?
I'll talk to him, but you can talk to him yourself, too, later. Come on, son.
Yes,
sir. Sit down in that chair by the fire, Mrs. Hale. It's the most comfortable chair in the White House.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Now tell me, how can I help you?
Well, Mr. President, I wanted to talk to you about issuing a presidential proclamation declaring a day of national thanksgiving.
A presidential proclamation, a day of national thanksgiving?
Yes.
But, Mrs. Hale, these are heartbreaking days throughout this land. These are days of uncertainty and war, death. What will the mothers and fathers who are in mourning say to me if I ask them to give thanks now? What will the men on the field say of the sweethearts they've left behind them?
Well, Mr. President, I thought that especially in these times we should pause for a day of thanks and to count up the blessings we do have.
Yes, I admit there is something in what you say, and I'll give it some thought. You said you were the editor of Godey's Lady Book, Mrs. Hale?
Yes, Mr. President.
It's most unusual to meet a woman editor. How did you happen to acquire this position?
Well, until my husband's death, I lived a most quiet life. Then I had to provide for my five children. So I decided to try my hand at writing. I wrote poetry for a time. And then a novel called Northwood.
Northwood? Oh, yes, yes, I know of it.
As a result of my book, I was given the editorship of a magazine in Boston. And a few years later, Mr. Godey bought out the magazine and asked me to accept the position of literary editor of the Lady's Book. I love my work, Mr. President. I'm 75 years old now. And I hope I'm still working on a lady book when I'm 90.
Bless you, Mrs. Hale. I hope you are, too. Well, now I'll think over your suggestion of a proclamation, and I'll let you know what I decide. Where may I reach you?
My address is written on this card, Mr. Bell.
Well, I'll get in touch with you in a day or so.
Good night, Mr. Bell. Thank you for receiving me.
May I send for my carriage to take you home? It's a bad storm out.
Thank you. I have a carriage waiting. Good night again.
Good night.
Was that Mrs. Hale leaving?
Yes.
What did she want?
She wanted me to declare a national day of thanksgiving.
Oh. Well, now, don't you think you'd better get upstairs and try to get some rest?
Oh, I still have some work I must do, and I want to think about Mrs. Hale's suggestion and...
Now what?
I'll go. Can I help you?
Oh. We want to see the President of the United States.
Well, come right in.
My, it's cold out.
What did you want with the President?
Well, Elizabeth and me... this is Elizabeth here. We're eloping, and we...
You're Southerners, aren't you?
Yes, ma'am. We're Virginians, ma'am.
I see. Well, what are you doing here?
Tom, can I whisper in your ear? Excuse us.
Of course. Oh, yeah. We think... That is, I think we better wait and tell our business to the president.
Well, I'm the president.
Elizabeth, he's the president.
Are you really, sir?
I really am. Why?
Well, he just looks sort of different from the way I've heard Teddy and Milton in Virginia.
Well, I imagine I do.
How do they say he looks in Virginia?
Well, they say...
Excuse us.
Oh, well, I wasn't going to tell him that.
I didn't know.
Come into my study, won't you, and tell me what I can do for you. Is it all right if my wife comes, too?
Elizabeth?
Oh, yes. I wish she would.
Well, you better take off that wet wrap.
Yes, thanks.
Oh, here, let me take it. I don't know what happened to my manners, but you startled me so. I'll hang it right up.
Come in by the fire, won't you?
You see, sir, we were eloping to Harper's Ferry, but we weren't able to get married there, and so we came on to Washington.
And when we got here, we asked the men on the street what we had to do to get married, and they said we had to come to the White House and get the president's permission.
We hope you'll give it to us, sir, because, well, we sure do want to get married.
Sir, may I whisper in your ear a minute? Excuse us, Miss Baker.
Oh, sure. Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
Oh, yeah. You see, furthermore, Mr. President, we could never make it back home before morning, and it would be doggone awkward.
Your language.
Oh, pardon me, Mr. Pardon me, Mr. President.
Oh, that's quite all right.
It'd be pretty awkward to explain where we'd been all night.
Have I missed anything?
The young people want to get married, dear, and someone told them they had to ask my permission.
Oh, but that's so...
So, of course, I have given it. And now we must see if we can locate a minister tonight.
Tonight?
Oh, yes, tonight. Things would be most awkward in Virginia if we didn't find a minister tonight.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, it's pretty terrible to contemplate, Mr. President. Elizabeth's brothers... You know, men have been tarred and feathered for less than this.
And Tom would look perfectly terrible in tar and feathers.
I'd feel terrible, too.
Well, I could send one of the servants out in the carriage for a minister. If you think that's the thing to do, dear.
Oh, I definitely think that's the thing to do, my dear.
Well, then I'll take care of it once. My dear, don't you want to come with me? You'll want to freshen up.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of
you. Phew. It's a pretty serious step. Step like this for a man.
You're quite right about that.
Tell me frankly, sir, were you scared when you got right up to the final moment?
Son, I was so scared that I didn't show up at the altar.
You didn't?
I did not.
You left a lady waiting at the altar?
I'm afraid I did.
Well, Mr. President, if you'll forgive me, sir, that was a shabby Yankee trick, sir.
It was a cowardly trick. But I got so scared.
What'd the lady say?
Well, she didn't say anything to me at the time. She didn't speak to me for a good long time after that.
Oh, we're made of sterner stuff in Virginia, sir.
Yes, so I've been told. But she finally forgave me, and we got married right away, so I wouldn't have too much time to think about it. That's the best way to do it.
Yes, sir. I guess the less time you have to think about it, the better, all right.
Hello.
Oh, hello, son. Come on in. This is my boy, Mr.
Yes, sir. Yes. Tom Ayers.
You the one that's getting married?
I certainly am.
I got two goats.
Oh. Oh, that's nice.
I've got a pony, too. You got a pony?
No.
Got any goats?
No.
Just a girl, huh?
Oh, yeah, but...
Well, I'd rather have my two goats.
Well, you won't feel that way when you're Mr. Ayers' age, my son.
And you mustn't forget to scold me before you go to bed, Father. Mother will be very angry if you don't scold me.
I'll try to remember.
Well, I'm not supposed to bring the goats in the White House, you know. It was very naughty of me.
Well, that's what your mother says.
You got to be strict with me. Mother says you've got to be strict with me the way she is.
Well, I know. Well, I'm going to be the first chance I get.
Well, the carriage is gone and Elizabeth is upstairs. Mr. Ayers, Elizabeth tells me that you're going to fight with our armies.
Yes, ma'am. I believe in this country. And I want to have a hand in defending what I believe in.
Hooray! Spoken like a soldier.
No, my son. Spoken like a good American. Come along with me, Mr. Ayers. You'll want to fix up a little for your wedding, won't you?
I would appreciate that, sir.
Now, come along, then. Now, dear, no matter what else happens tonight, please don't let me forget to think about that Thanksgiving proclamation.
I'll remind you, Father. Before you have to go to bed, you have to think about the Thanksgiving proclamation. And you have to scold me.
Well, there's no rest for a president and no rest for a father. Come along, Mr. Ayers, won't you? Come along. Well,
Have you guessed who the president was when all this happened? It really did happen, you know, so listen closely. The president had decided to have a quiet evening at home. He had planned to spend it in complete solitude going over his problems. But fate seemed to will otherwise.
Do you know what your son is doing?
I'm afraid to guess.
He's getting dressed in his uniform for the wedding.
No.
Yes.
Well, I told the Secretary of War he was starting something when he had the boy appointed a lieutenant of the United States Volunteers and gave him that uniform. He looks good in a uniform, too.
Perhaps, to a man.
Well, my dear, don't you want to go and fix up for the wedding yourself?
Well, I suppose perhaps I'd better. I won't be long. The minister should be here any minute.
Now, if I can just have a few minutes of quiet to go over some papers, huh? Now what?
Isn't there anybody down there to open that door?
I'll get it, my dear.
I don't know where the servants are tonight. I can't seem to find anyone. Jonathan should be taking care of the door.
Yes?
Are you the president? Why, yes, of course, sir. I saw the lights on downstairs, and so I knew you were up, and I just wanted to stop by and shake your hand again. Won't stay but a minute.
Oh, come in, won't you?
Thank you. Won't stay but a minute. I know you won't remember me, but I met you once a long time ago, and I wanted to shake your hand again.
Why, it's Farmer Peters. Farmer Henry Peters. What do you mean I wouldn't remember you?
You do remember. Well, well.
Of course I do.
It's been close to 30 years since we last met.
Is it? Let me see now. I was running for the legislature.
That's right, and you wanted my support. You got it, too.
And you invited me to dinner.
I did, but you said you weren't hungry, and you said if I'd leave my side, you'd mow a couple of rows for me.
Yes, and I mowed three. You know, I remember it as if it was yesterday. Tell me, how's your wife?
Well, she's well, Mr. President. She's at the hotel. It was a mite wet out for her tonight, though. She'll be sorry she didn't come, though, and she hears where I've been.
Oh, I'm sorry she isn't, will you? You know, she made the best apple pies in that part of the country.
I'll tell her you said that. Say, Mr. President, there's something I've been wanting to ask you these 30 years.
Really? What's that?
I searched the place over. Where on earth did you put my whetstone that day?
Well, now, let me see. Did I use it? Yes, yes, I did. I remember you. Yes, I remember using it. Let me see. Oh, yes, yes. I put it on top of the gatepost.
Well, I'll be hanged. It's probably still there. Hey, that's the first thing I look for when I get home.
Well, you write and tell me if you find it, huh? Would you care to come before the fire?
No. I've got to get back to the hotel. My wife will be wondering what's become of me. And it's real good to shake your hand again and be remembered by you, Miss President. Good night.
Good night, Farmer Peters. Drop by any time. It's always good to see a man from home.
Good night, Mr. President.
Good night.
Any sign of Jonathan, Mr. President?
Of Jonathan?
Yes.
I'm out here, Mr. President.
Is that you, Jonathan?
Yes, Mr. President.
Well, come in. What were you doing out there?
I'm doing sentry duty, sir.
You're doing what?
I'm doing sentry duty.
But you're a house servant. Who put you on sentry duty?
Master Thomas, sir.
Thomas, my son?
Thomas did what?
Well, as soon as he was appointed a lieutenant, he organized a company from the White House servants, sir, and he's got us all on sentry duty.
Well, where are the regular sentries?
He dismissed them.
Mr. President, that's nothing to laugh about. Heavens, you sound like you have a dreadful cold. Now, Jonathan, you go and tell the servants to return to their proper places and send word for the sentries to return to theirs. My goodness.
Why did you obey Thomas Johnson?
Well, sir, he pulled his rank on us. It seemed to be a choice of going on sentry duty or being shot at sunrise. Naturally, none of us wanted to be shot.
Naturally. All right, Jonathan. Put things back to order if you can.
Yes, Mr. President.
You're certainly going to have to speak to that boy.
Yes, Mrs. President. Now I must get some work done. No.
I'll answer it. Oh, it's the minister. Come in, Reverend.
Good evening, Mrs. President. Mr. President, it's a wet night out.
It was very good of you to come. This is something in the nature of an emergency, or we would never have asked you.
I can't imagine any greater honor than being asked to perform a wedding at the White House. Is your son?
No, it's none of my sons, Reverend. But it is two of my children. My dear, will you call them? It's getting late, and there's no point in delaying the ceremony.
Yes, I'll call them immediately.
What's the status
me. I wish you both a long and very happy lifetime.
Thank you, Mr. Fenton.
Thank you, sir. We both appreciate all you've done for us.
Well, now that the ceremony is over, you have no further use for me until your first christening. So, with your permission, Mr. President, I'll be on my way.
Thank you. Thank you for helping us, Reverend.
We'd better be on our way, too, Tony.
Yes, we must.
No, we won't hear of it. You're going to stay at the White House for the night. It's much too late to go in search of other lodging.
It certainly is, and we'll be very happy to have you as our guest.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Benson. Oh, this will be something to remember all the rest of our lives.
Oh, it certainly will. And to tell our children.
Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry, Elizabeth. I didn't mean to be indelicate.
May I whisper something, Tom? Excuse us, please.
Certainly.
Oh, yeah. Elizabeth wants me to say that we'll name our first child for you, Mr. President, even if it's a girl.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. That's a very great honor.
Oh, I certainly never thought I'd name any child of mine after a Yankee. But you're just as nice as any gentleman in Virginia. In fact, you're the nicest gentleman I've ever met. Outside of town, of course.
Well, Elizabeth, that's just about the nicest compliment I ever had in my life. Now, if you'll excuse me, I really must get to my desk. I have some work that must get done.
Father?
Thomas, what on earth are you doing up?
Well, I woke up, and I remembered. You didn't scold me for bringing the goats in the White House.
Oh, that's right. I didn't. Thomas, don't bring the goats in the White House anymore.
No, sir.
It was very naughty of you.
Yes, sir.
So, consider yourself scolded. Give me a kiss and go to bed.
Yes, sir.
Come on, scoot.
Thomas, you have no business up at this hour.
Well, I was just getting my scolding, Mother. Good night.
Good night. Hurry now and go to bed.
Yes, sir. Good night.
Good night, son.
Now, Mr. President, it's time that you were in bed, too.
So, you know, it stopped raining. Look how clear it is, huh?
Yes, we're going to have a beautiful day tomorrow.
You know, I've been thinking of the Thanksgiving proclamation.
Yes?
Yes. You know, we do have many things that we must thank God for the sun, the rain, the earth, and the fruits thereof, for the hope that comes when the hour seems darkest, for the ideas and the ideals left us by our fathers, for the loved ones that comfort us and sustain us, for the young people about us, like those two tonight, starting out hand in hand with their eyes on the future. And for that future that we know will come, when man will be at peace with his fellow man. And the United States will indeed be a united group of states. Yes, many things that we must thank God for. There are many. The food on our table, the roof over our table, the clothes we wear, the wood we burn, the beds we sleep in. Simple things. Yet things so important to our fathers that when they came to this raw, untamed wilderness, they fell on their knees and gave thanks for food, for shelter, and for life itself. Yes, no matter what sorrows we carry in our hearts, no matter what we have lost, we still have much to thank God for.
Have you decided what day will be the day of Thanksgiving, Mr. President?
I think the last Thursday in November will be the day. I'll ask Mr. Seward to write a proclamation tomorrow, and then I must remember to send word to Mrs. Hale.
Well, then, happy Thanksgiving, Mr. President.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, my dear. And happy Thanksgiving to the entire country.
Up the proclamation as you instructed me, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Seward.
You know, it's strange when you stop to think of it, but this is the first national Thanksgiving proclamation since the day of Washington, Mr. President.
Yes. Let me read it, Mr. Seward. The year that is drawing to a close has been filled with the blessings of fruitful fields and healthful skies. To these bounties which are so constantly enjoyed that we are prone to forget the source from which they come, others have been added, which are of so extraordinary a nature that they cannot fail to penetrate and soften the heart, which is habitually insensible to the ever-watchful providence of Almighty God.
needful diversions of wealth and of strength from the fields of peaceful industry to the national defense have not arrested the plow, the shuttle, or the ship. The axe has enlarged the borders of our settlement. And the mines, as well of iron and coal as of the precious metals, have yielded more abundantly than heretofore. No human counsel has devised, nor hath any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gifts of the Most High God, who, while dealing with us in anger for our sins, hath nevertheless remembered us in mercy. I do therefore invite my fellow citizens in every part of the United States, and also those who are at sea and those who are sojourning in foreign lands, to set apart and observe the last Thursday of November next as a day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens.
Will you sign that, Mr. President?
I will with pleasure, Mr. Seward. A. Lincoln. Be with us again next week, won't you, for another interesting story that happened in Washington a few years ago to Mr. President. Until then, goodbye. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Mr. President on Tuned To Yesterday from November 20th, 1949 on ABC. Edward Arnold was Abraham Lincoln in that broadcast. At the time of the series, the president himself, Harry S. Truman, upon meeting Edward Arnold for the first time, greeted him as Mr. President. And that wraps this hour of True History on Tuned To Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levillier. Thanks for tuning in.